actually tougher than you think. You never knew that. And maybe you didn't want to take on the responsibility because, you know, people play a role in their own demise, so to speak. When you had opportunity to go out and explore or withdraw because you were afraid, you chose to withdraw because you were afraid. So it's not only that you were overprotected often, it's that you were willing to take advantage of the fact that you were overprotected and run back there whenever you had the opportunity. You know, so maybe you're a kid in the playground, right, and you're having some trouble with other kids, and you know in the back of your mind, I should deal with this myself, but you go and tell your mom and get her to intervene. And you know that that's not right. You know that you're breaking the social contract, but it's easier, and so that's what you do. You run off to an authority figure and hide behind the great father, right, roughly speaking. Well, the problem with that is you don't learn how to do it yourself. So then you have to relearn it painfully when you're 40. So then you take people out. You say, well, what are you afraid of? Rank it from 1 to 10. So 10 is, we'll make a list of 10 things you're afraid of. The thing you're least afraid of, we'll call number 10. So we'll start with that. Okay, well, I'm afraid of elevators. Okay, well, let's look at a picture of an elevator. Let's have you imagine being in an elevator. Let's go out to an elevator and let you watch the terrible jaws of death open, because that's how you're responding to it symbolically, right? And you're going to do that at the closest proximity you can manage. You find out, you go do that, it works. You're nervous as hell, especially from an anticipatory perspective, shaking. You go out, you stop, you watch it happen, and you actually calm down. You do that 10 times and it no longer bothers you. Well, what you've learned, that you didn't die, but more importantly than that, you've learned that you could withstand the threat of death. That's what you've learned. And then you move a little closer, and then you move a little closer, and then you move a little closer, and finally you're back in what's no longer the elevator from a symbolic perspective. It's a tomb, right? It's a place of enclosure and isolation. And you learn, turns out I can withstand that. And then you're met much more together, much more confident. And that's often one of the things that often happens in situations like that. I've seen this multiple times, is that if you run someone through an exposure training process like that and toughen them up, they'll often start standing up to people around them in a way they never did before. Sometimes people are bullied because they can't fight back. This can happen to people who are weaker physically than their opponents. This is one of the most common reasons for the bullying experienced by children. Even the toughest of 6-year-olds is no match for someone who is 9. A lot of that power differential disappears in adulthood, however, with the rough stabilization and matching of physical size, with the exception of that pertaining to men and women, with the former typically larger and stronger, particularly in the upper body, as well as the increased penalties. Generally applied in adulthood to those who insist upon continuing with physical intimidation. But just as often, people are bullied because they won't fight back. This happens not infrequently to people who are by temperament compassionate and self-sacrificing, particularly if they're also high in negative emotion and make a lot of gratifying noises of suffering when someone sadistic confronts them. Children who cry more easily, for example, are more frequently bullied. It also happens to people who have decided, for one reason or another, that all forms of aggression, including even feelings of anger, are morally wrong. I have seen people with a particularly acute sensitivity to petty tyranny and over-aggressive competitiveness restrict within themselves all the emotions that might give rise to such things. With their capacity for aggression straight, jacketed within a too narrow morality, those who are only or merely compassionate and self-sacrificing and naive and exploitable cannot call forth the genuinely righteous and appropriately self-protective anger necessary to defend themselves. If you can bite, you generally don't have to. When skillfully integrated, the ability to respond with aggression and violence decreases, rather than increases the probability that actual aggression will become necessary. If you say no early in the cycle of oppression, and you mean what you say, which means you state your refusal in no uncertain terms and stand behind it, then the scope for oppression on the part of oppressor will remain properly bounded and limited. Naive, harmless people usually guide their perceptions and actions with a few simple axioms. People are basically good. No one really wants to hurt anyone else, the threat. And Certainly, the use of force, physical or otherwise, is wrong. These axioms collapse, or worse, in the presence of individuals who are genuinely malevolent. Worse means that naive beliefs can become a positive invitation to abuse, because those who aim to harm have become specialized to prey on people who think precisely such things. Under such conditions, the axioms of harmlessness must be retooled. In my clinical practice, I often draw the attention of my clients who think that good people never become angry to the stark realities of their own resentments. No one likes to be pushed around, but people often put up with it for too long. So I get them to see their resentment first as anger, and then as an indication that something needs to be said, if not done, not least because honesty demands it. Then I get them to see such action as part of the force that holds tyranny at bay, at the social level, as much as the individual. Many bureaucracies have petty authoritarians within them, generating unnecessary rules and procedures simply to express and cement power. Such people produce powerful undercurrents of resentment around them, which, if expressed, would limit their expression of pathological power. It is in this manner that the willingness of the individual to stand up for him or herself protects everyone from the corruption of society. When naive people discover the capacity for anger within themselves, they are shocked, sometimes severely. A profound example of that can be found in the susceptibility of new soldiers to post-traumatic stress disorder, which often occurs because of something they watch themselves doing, rather than because of something that has happened to them. They react like the monsters they can truly be in extreme battlefield conditions, and the revelation of that capacity undoes their world. And no wonder, perhaps they assumed that all of history's terrible perpetrators were people totally unlike themselves. Perhaps they were never able to see within themselves the capacity for oppression and bullying, and perhaps not their capacity for assertion and success as well. I have had clients who were terrified into literally years of daily hysterical convulsions by the sheer look of malevolence on their attackers' faces. Such individuals typically come from hyper-sheltered families, where nothing terrible is allowed to exist, and everything is fairyland wonderful, or else. When the awakening occurs, when once naive people recognize in themselves the seeds of evil and monstrosity, and see themselves as dangerous, at least potentially, their fear decreases. They develop more self-respect. Then perhaps they begin to resist oppression. They see that they have the ability to withstand because they are terrible too. They see they can and must stand up because they begin to understand how genuinely monstrous they will become, otherwise feeding on their resentment, transforming it into the most destructive of wishes. To say it again, there is very little difference between the capacity for mayhem and destruction, integrated, and strength of character. This is one of the most difficult lessons of life.
Life is difficult. And you cannot protect your children. What you can do is prepare them, and you can prepare them to be strong and courageous and truthful and resilient and reciprocal in their interactions with other people. And that means you equip them for what life will be, which is at minimum a series of difficult challenges, and often more than that, because of course people go through very difficult times in their lives. And a resilient person is capable of standing up to things in the face of fear and moving forward voluntarily, convinced of their own competence and ability to prevail. And so your primary goal as a parent, apart from facilitating your child's social desirability, which is a major obligation on your part, is to encourage your children and I mean that literally, to instill in them a sense of courage in the face of the difficulties of life, and not to protect them from that. We don't even want to be protected from those difficulties, because a major part of life and its meaning is the challenge that comes with confronting difficulties.
Maybe you are a loser, and maybe you're not. But if you are, you don't have to continue in that mode. Maybe you just have a bad habit. Maybe you're even just a collection of bad habits. Nonetheless, even if you came by your poor posture, honestly, even if you were unpopular or bullied at home or in grade school, it's not necessarily appropriate now. Circumstances change. If you slump around with the same bearing that characterizes a defeated lobster, people will assign you a lower status, and the old counter that you share with crustaceans sitting at the very base of your brain will assign you a low dominance number. Then your brain will not produce as much serotonin. This will make you less happy and more anxious and sad, and more likely to back down when you should stand up for yourself. It will also decrease the probability that you will get to live in a good neighborhood, have access to the highest quality resources, and obtain a healthy, desirable mate. It will render you more likely to abuse cocaine and alcohol as you live for the present in a world full of uncertain futures. It will increase your susceptibility to heart disease, cancer, and dementia. All in all, it's just not good. Circumstances change, and so can you. Positive feedback loops, adding effect to effect, can spiral counterproductively in a negative direction, but can also work to get you ahead. That's the other, far more optimistic lesson of Price's Law and the Pareto distribution. Those who start to have will probably get more. Some of these upwardly moving loops can occur in your own private subjective space. Alterations in body language offer an important example. If you are asked by a researcher to move your facial muscles, one at a time, into a position that would look sad to an observer, you will report feeling sadder. If you are asked to move the muscles one by one into a position that looks happy, you will report feeling happier. Emotion is partly bodily expression and can be amplified or dampened by that expression. Some of the positive feedback loops instantiated by body language can occur beyond the private confines of subjective experience in the social space you share with other people. If your posture is poor, for example, if you slump, shoulders forward and rounded, chest tucked in, head down, looking small, defeated and ineffectual, protected in theory against attack from behind, then you will feel small, defeated and ineffectual. The reactions of others will amplify that. People like lobsters size each other up, partly in consequence of stance. If you present yourself as defeated, then people will react to you as if you are losing. If you start to straighten up, then people will look at and treat you differently. You might object. The bottom is real. Being at the bottom is equally real. A mere transformation of posture is insufficient to change anything that fixed. If you're in number 10 position, then standing up straight and appearing dominant might only attract the attention of those who want, once again, to put you down. And fair enough, but standing up straight with your shoulders back is not something that is only physical, because you're not only a body. You're a spirit, so to speak, a psyche. As well, standing up physically also implies and invokes and demands standing up metaphysically. Standing up means voluntarily accepting the burden of being. Your nervous system responds in an entirely different manner when you face the demands of life voluntarily. You respond to a challenge instead of bracing for a catastrophe. You see the gold the dragon hoards instead of shrinking in terror from the all too real fact of the dragon. You step forward to take your place in the dominance hierarchy and occupy your territory, manifesting your willingness to defend, expand, and transform it. That can all occur practically or symbolically as a physical or as a conceptual restructuring. To stand up straight with your shoulders back is to accept the terrible responsibility of life with eyes wide open. It means deciding to voluntarily transform the chaos of potential into the realities of habitable order. It means adopting the burden of self-conscious vulnerability and accepting the end of the unconscious paradise of childhood, where finitude and mortality are only dimly comprehended. It means willingly undertaking the sacrifices necessary to generate a productive and meaningful reality. It means acting to please God in the ancient language. To stand up straight with your shoulders back means building the ark that protects the world from the flood, guiding your people through the desert after they have escaped tyranny, making your way away from comfortable home and country, and speaking the prophetic word to those who ignore the widow and children. It means shouldering the cross that marks the X, the place where you and being intersect so terribly. It means casting dead, rigid, and too tyrannical order back into the chaos in which it was generated. It means withstanding the ensuing uncertainty and establishing, in consequence, a better, more meaningful, and more productive order. So, Attend carefully to your posture. Quit drooping and hunching around. Speak your mind. Put your desires forward as if you had a right to them, at least the same right as others. Walk tall and gaze forthrightly ahead. Dare to be dangerous. Encourage the serotonin to flow plentifully through the neural pathways, desperate for its calming influence. People, including yourself, will start to assume that you are competent and able, or at least they will not immediately conclude the reverse. Emboldened by the positive responses you are now receiving, you will begin to be less anxious. You will then find it easier to pay attention to the subtle social clues that people exchange when they are communicating. Your conversations will flow better, with fewer awkward pauses. This will make you more likely to meet people, interact with them, and impress them. Doing so will not only genuinely increase the probability that good things will happen to you, it will also make those good things feel better when they do happen. Thus, strengthened and emboldened, you may choose to embrace being and work for its furtherance and improvement.